Buddy, or good morning, depending on where you are, good middle of the day. This is Larry Rosenstock with the Apollo 13 crew, where everything is technically proficient tonight. Class number two of New School Creation by the Berklee Graduate School of Education and the High Tech High Graduate School of Education. I am going to ask each of our panelists for tonight's chat to please introduce themselves. Go ahead.
I'm Ann Worrell. I'm the director at High Tech Elementary School in Chula Vista, First Elementary.
Jeff?
I'm Jeff Robin. I'm an art teacher at High Tech High.
Kelly?
Hi, I'm Kelly. I direct the School Leadership MED program, and I've been a teacher and a director at High Tech High and been here the past 12 years.
Maria?
Hi, I'm Maria Heredia, and I'm general counsel at High Tech High.
And Patrick?
Hi, my name is Patrick Garrick, and I'm the instructor of the New School of Creation.
Okay, so we assume last week we showed a video that we had already put on the site, and we've had a debate, you should all know, as to whether we should show a little 4 or 5 minute video each time we have this presentation of a Hangout. So please feel free to email us your thoughts about that if you would like to revisit a video and have us comment on it, because we're going two ways about it. We're not going to see one tonight, so we'll have a slightly shorter session. I'm going to answer the first question, and then Maria will take a shot at it as well. Voted most popular, actually. How do you balance different drivers of a school's purpose? Student outcomes, shared experiences, pedagogy, philosophy, and, quote, things to keep out, all play a part. How can you ensure they're harmoniously blended? How do you find the core? That's a very good question to ask. I would say that that is the core question. I think it's the constant work of making it better and balancing all of those pressures and taking a really close look at what's really going on in your school and seeing if you're being clear and focused. I don't think that you need to crowd out your narrative with views of everything every time you're talking about it. I think it should be short and sweet. Maria, would you like to say something about that? Because this is from Tom from New Hampshire. You have helped so many schools develop their narrative in a more complex legal sense in their authorization proposals.
Sure. And so I think the narrative of your school is definitely going to reflect how you're going to do things differently. And you're right, Larry, that even though there's this tension maybe from some outside forces like authorizers or community members or funders, you should really stick to what you intend to do. And the balance, I think, sometimes comes from articulating your narrative with depth, clarity, and then common vernacular that's going to resonate with some of those key stakeholders and also translate with external people and entities without losing your purpose, if that makes some sense.
My microphone was off. Sorry about that. Okay. Jeff, did you have your hand up because you wanted to say something about that, or were we going to move to the next one?
No, I was just noticed your microphone was off, and so I was kind of laughing.
Well, you know, we're keeping you up late, Jeff, so I need to do whatever I can. Okay, so the second question is the following. This is from Gabriel in Barcelona. Gabriel, I will be in Barcelona in March. Maybe we'll get to meet up. I'm looking forward to being there. I've never been there. The question is, if purpose is the why and mission is the what mechanisms do you use to keep them on tune with context changes? In other words, how do you take advantage of the creative, disruptive tension that may arise between rhetoric and practice? Well, first of all, that's a terrific question. I think that one thing is that you approach that by looking at what is actually going on in your school, looking at student work, having the purpose to be able to use, have the students have the purpose to use technology well, look at how you're doing integration, if you really are doing social class integration, how less advantaged students are doing within the context of students who have more come from homes with more advantage. Also, network studies are a very good idea. Go look at some of them. We have some on our website, for example, at High Tech High, where you can actually see who is asking whom questions within classes. And it's also made easier if you have a purpose and are on board. That's a clear purpose, so you can actually analyze all these things through the lens of that purpose. Anne, would you mind taking, Jeff, would you mind taking a little shot at this question?
Well, when we first opened the school, so I am one of the, from the first class, it's the first teaching class that was at the school, it's almost like we think of what's the opposite thing that you would do in a high school. I always, back then when we first opened, I thought, what did we do in graduate school? And that's how I teach. And I still do that now. I'm still doing projects that I would have maybe done when I was getting my master's in fine arts instead of just doing what a normal curriculum would be in 11th grade. So it's almost like not having any preconceived notions that this is a high school thing or this is a college thing, and to let it expand out, and it really breeds itself. When I do a project that people wouldn't think was a normal high school project, then other people start doing it as well, and it really grows, and this idea that you can do anything. We even did a project that was called a Frontier Project. Let's do a project about things that would never be in a normal high school. And we put jazz in the bathroom. We have words of wisdom, glued to the ceiling. It's an intentionally trying to do what you don't normally see. And the benefits from that are tremendous, or can be tremendous, and it can be tremendous to the students and also to the faculty, because you feel free, and it gives the faculty ownership, and it makes the kids feel like, wow, I really have a voice.
Okay. Hey, Jeff, there's something else I want to ask. Oh, Kelly wants to say something about that.
Oh, go ahead. I can after.
Okay. I'm going to feed this to Jeff, and then Kelly, you can go first. Jeff, mm-hmm. I want you to consider while Kelly's speaking. I met a teacher from New Hampshire who once, years ago, artfully said, let the project dictate the curriculum rather than the other way around. Okay? Would you address that? Go ahead, Kelly.
Yeah, I was thinking about the idea of creative disruption, and I think the power is in students and teachers being engaged and constantly reinventing their school. So we had a really powerful discussion with all of our K through 12 directors or principals about what's at the core of our schools, what's in service to that core, and what stimulates progress. So not becoming, not regressing into the norm or getting into the habit of doing things just because that's what we've done for many years. So we talked about at the core, our schools are really about progressive pedagogy, social class integration, not separating kids out because of their background or perceived ability. So out of that conversation at one of the schools, teachers decided to mix up the grade levels and do a really awesome project called Projectopia, where instead of doing projects in teams by grade level, the students created their own projects through their advisor with kids of different ages. So I think the more that students have teachers have voice and they're brought into that conversation, the more disruption and creativity you'll see in schools.
Thanks so much. Jeff, do you want to say a quick response to this question of letting the project dictate the curriculum rather than the other way around?
Yeah, so when the project dictates the curriculum, the kids go in places that you wouldn't normally expect. I always say do the project yourself first, and that's really just a jumping off point where I would make it, and I would say, this is what I've done. I expect more. I'm kind of setting the floor, and then you get to see where the kids go, and that lets them, that adds to ownership, that adds to them feeling that it's their project, not my assignment. So it really goes out from there, and you get things that are just amazing. And what it does is for the kids that are advanced and the kids that are really, that have been hardworking and have been for a long time, it lets them feel like, wow, I could really go for the stars. And the kids that haven't been realize, wait, here's a real opportunity for me to do something in the direction that I'm interested in. And then, as a teacher, you kind of shape it or massage the project to a place where everybody's, successful and everybody feels good about what they've done.
Okay, thanks, Jeff. The next question is, from Katerina again, who asked a great question last week. Thank you for keep coming forth with these ones, Katerina. Does your purpose statement have to address aspects from all stakeholders, that parens, students, parents, teacher, funders, etc., or can you pinpoint it to one? And before Kelly addresses this, I want to say that this is something I do feel very strongly about. I think that just much like we've all seen mission statements for organizations, if you have too many things in the mix, then you land up going to the lowest common denominator. And your mission statement is not something that's supposed to make everybody happy. It's supposed to be something really clipped. I change in a way all the time. I could say, I think I was about social class integration and constructivist pedagogy, where students are making things that are of value to them, learning things that are of value to them, period. So there's a lot of different ways to do it, but I don't need to throw in the many, many other things every time you talk about it. I think the more reduced it is, the clearer it is. Mm-hmm. Kelly, you want to say something about that?
Yeah, I think most of us would struggle to say right now what the mission statement is of High Tech High, but the design principles we could all speak to, and there are a few, and they're sticky, so personalization, adult world connection, common intellectual mission. I think thinking about the design principles, about things that will keep you connected to your core, and when people try to pull you from that, you have common language. So, for example, there was a question about teachers challenging separating out kids by ability in math classrooms. Well, we know that kids have a double disadvantage that come from low income, EL, foster youth, that when they are surrounded by other kids that also have come from kind of a culture of poverty and been disadvantaged by schools, they're going to struggle that much more. So we'll have kids, if we separated them out, that will follow predictable patterns as far as who ends up at college or not. So we can go back to that design principle when people say, wouldn't it be easier if we could just put the kids in math classrooms and based on their ability? We could say, perhaps, but that's not the problem we want to have. We'd rather have the problem of learning how to teach kids all together. So I think if you think of those sticky things that are most core and they're most disruptive, name those and make them design principles.
That's great, and that also morphed into question number 4, in which Kay asked specifically about our experience in that regard, and I would add to that this is why this is where you need strong leadership. You know, about doing what is the right thing to do, but not the easiest thing to do. I'm not generally in favor of the strong hand of authoritarian leadership, but I think that the leader of the school must be the protector of what Kelly was talking about and of the core mission, even if parents and students want something else. Because when you're first creating a school and you're talking to parents, they say, oh, well, this isn't what schools look like, what you're talking about. And you should say, correct. Because we really need differentiated schools. That's the point. Yes, Maria?
I just wanted to add that you also have to analyze opportunities as they come up, because I know we've done that here. There are partners out in the community, people that get excited about something that's going on at your school, and they have an idea, and they come to you with their idea, and you really have to look at that idea and say, well, it's wonderful, but is it part of where we're going? And there's always that temptation to get excited and go off on a tangent, but you need to really understand what it is you're doing so that you don't go off on a tangent that's not on your mission.
Mm-hmm. Were you talking to me?
Yes.
One of the things that I knew in the very beginning, we kind of had to explain project-based learning to the parents. We really had to tell them when we first opened the school that, you know, they would come and tell us, wow, you know, my kid's so happy. There must be something going on. I mean, they're so happy and they love school. You guys must be doing something wrong. And so we had to explain it to the parents. And then I remember a couple years later, we had to explain it to the kids again, like in the next generation of students from the very beginning. Yeah, we're doing projects and you're learning from these projects. And then just even recently, I've had to explain it to a lot of the new staff who have been here for just maybe, you know, from 1 year to 5 or 6 years why we're doing what we're doing. So it's this constant conversation. That was just around project-based learning, but it's about everything. Mm-hmm. You need to always be talking about your mission, your goals, and what the school's about. It's a never-ending conversation, and you can't get bored of doing it, mm-hmm. or you're going to lose your way. You have to keep going, and it's sometimes a heavy weight, and then sometimes it's something that's really exciting, and that you're able to share it with other people. Mm-hmm. But it definitely, you have to keep having that same conversation over and over again. Mm-hmm.
I think Maria's point about being mission aligned is really important, because people are going to have various ideas and they're going to bring them to you. Like cheerleading was introduced into our schools. It's something we had intentionally kept out. There were a group of students at one of the schools that wanted to get it started. They had ideas since they were little girls of being cheerleaders, of wearing the uniforms, wearing them to school. And so a teacher had started supporting them. Parents got around it. And we had to bring that whole group together after it already gained some momentum, which was the unfortunate part, and explain how equity is a central part of our school and the gender issues that come about when girls are being sexualized and on the sidelines kind of cheering on boy sports that are dominated by boys. So what you'd want is, if everyone had kind of a shared purpose around that, you'd hope that that teacher would have said, you know what, I know that you would love to be a cheerleader. That's not something we do here. That's why. That would have been better than us having to go in later. So I think you're, again, trying to have conversations about purpose all the time, so that students are telling other students and teachers are telling other teachers or parents, this is what we do and why, and this is what we don't do and why.
And that coming in later, by the way, I remember how shocked we were when all of a sudden there were a bunch of young women in cheerleader outfits. And we were like, what happened? We found out the hard way. So we have a really great question from Rush, who is from Earth, which is nearly and dear to us, all of us. So basically, the question is, how do you shift the culture? People can only filter through their own experience. Is it possible to shift people to a growth mindset and get on board with doing school differently? Well, you know, as one person once said to me, there's only three things people care about in organizational change. What does it mean to me? What does it mean to me? And what does it mean to me? It is far harder to change the culture of an existing school than to create a new one, as complex as it is to do so, of creating a new school. So this course could be called New School Creation and New School Recreation. In terms of, before passing this to Anne, for rules of the road that we use back in one of the oldest high schools in the United States from the 1600s that I also worked in for years with some wonderful folks, we had two rules. One was that some of us are going to try something different in part of this school, and if you don't want to do it, you don't have to do it. And the second rule was, if you don't want to do it, you don't have to do it, but you can't stop those of us who do want to do it from doing it. So those are the types of rules of the road that you create to sort of create the space for yourself for pockets of innovation within existing schools. I think it's much better to create those pockets than to rely on the entire organization to shift its culture at one point. Anne, you want to comment on that?
I do, actually. I was thinking that part of a possible response for Rush's question is embedded within his question, which is that people can only filter through their experience. And I think one way to get at it is to honor and to capitalize on those experiences. People bring things to the table that they want to share. There are people with expertise all over the school, regardless of what they're teaching. And if you can tap into why they're teaching and why they chose teaching and connect that to your goal, whatever that shift is that you want for your culture, and help them draw the connections between what's important to them and this goal, then they have a genuine voice in what that new culture looks like. Maybe their experience is something that a lot of people don't want to do things because they're afraid, and that mind shift where you're not able to really look at change is grounded in fear. And if it's one or two people with a fear, then that's handled one way. But if, like, a large group of people are sharing an experience that had some barriers, then get together as a group and talk about, like, why was that a barrier and what are the solutions to it so we don't have that as a barrier now. So their voices are genuinely in it. I think that reduces the vulnerability, and I think it honors that the autonomy that everybody wants to have in their work when they feel good about their work. So I don't know if you want to add to that, Larry, or.
Well, I'm going to, Jeff, several of us here have worked in traditional schools prior to this. So if anyone else wants to jump in, or hearing none, I will move on. But pretty much, Jeff, you want to say something?
Sure. When I worked in a regular public school prior to this, I never...
Does that make us irregular, by the way? Go ahead.
Irregular, yeah. And I didn't fit in the regular, so the irregular seemed to do much better for me. I never got to work with another adult. We never spoke to each other. We never talked to each other. So there was a very limited possibility that there was going to be any change. And the fact that we meet, that we put into our culture, that we meet all the time and we talk to each other and there's a real conversation between adults, I think facilitates change. Because if you're sitting by yourself and all you know is what you know, yeah, then there's not going to be a lot of change. But it's the meeting. It's the fact that we meet twice, three times a week that changes ideas, changes perspectives, and that's one of the ways that as adults who had been to traditional schools before, we were able to change because we talked about it, and some of us were really excited about change. I love change no matter what, but other people were uncomfortable with it. But when you talk about it, it makes you feel better about the ideas that you're doing, and I think that was something that's really important is talking to each other and talking, teachers and administrators and the community talking will help people change.
Okay, Anne and then Maria.
I just wanted to add briefly to what Jeff is saying and Kelly touched on earlier, the idea of during those conversations that Jeff is talking about, honoring that disruption, and that so people do know that they can voice a contrary opinion or have a different perspective, and that's going to be listened to with equal weight. I think in traditional schools where I've worked, it was sort of a groupthink, and if you didn't go along with the group, that wasn't honored. And I think we honor all perspectives, and that helps shift that culture in a different way. Maria, sorry.
No, that's okay, thanks. I was just also going to say receptivity. So in the schools that when I see the language here, how do you shift the culture? That to me talks about not necessarily starting a new school from scratch, but introducing yourself or a change or an idea, a different idea in an existing community. So in the schools that I've seen around our community in our state, I've noticed that the community has to be able to welcome you, the teaching community, the parents. There has to be, if you're going into an existing structure or an existing school, there has to be a desire for that change. There has to be a group of folks who are receptive to change, who are willing to change, who want to do something differently. So that's the only piece that I wanted to add there, because I saw this word shift, and it reminds me of schools that are in transition.
Larry, I've got one example to add as far as a change in our schools, is that all right? One thing I think when people, I think the nail was hit on the head earlier about change often brings out fear and also a worry of loss or loss of control of what people are kind of used to. When we shifted, so I think it's really important that people can share their hopes and fears about a change and get those on the table and be part of the solutions that will address those fears. So when we moved from internships being run in our high schools, we had a full-time position of someone who coordinated internships. We changed that to 11th grade teachers really being involved in that process, and there were a lot of hopes and a lot of fears about that change. But once the teachers got those fears out, some of them being, how will we have time to do this? When will the students meet? Then we said, well, what do we do to address those fears, and what solutions do you have? Because those closest to the problem are closest to the solution. So teachers said, well, if we had team time on Fridays, we could be doing this with the 11th graders. So the more that people can voice their fears and then have ownership of the solutions that arise during the change process, the more on board I think they will be with that change.
I think a constant theme here for all of our takes on this very good question is that the adults need to be talking to each other and need to be talking to each other on a regular basis. A couple of years ago, someone said to me, if you were to come back to your schools in 20 years, what would really disappoint you? And I said, if I saw that people came in the morning, checked their mailbox, worked in the autonomous isolation of their classroom, and then went home, that would be very disappointing to me, and that would really signal a lot. So for the next question, this is from Leslie in Calgary, Alberta. Thank you, Leslie, for taking the time to send this to us. How do you keep the mission from falling prey to neglect because leadership and staff come and go? A really excellent question. Well, for us and for me, I think that the way, what you need to do, it's you always want to revisit your mission. Actually, the book Good to Great has a nice piece on that if you wanted to refer to it. But looking, if you don't want to be rigid about past practices, so what is it that you're flexible about and what not? You know, what really needs to remain constant in a school like ours is that we're not going to segregate by race or class, that we really want to have real-world audiences for our students' work, and I could list a lot of other ones. Those are things I think are somewhat non-negotiable. There's other things like the schedule, which actually can be very controlling in a lot of schools, and sometimes you're talking about whether it makes more sense to move this over here or have that over there. That is something that you could be thinking about. Is there anyone on board? I know that Jeff was going to say something before. Is there anyone who wants to say something about this question of leadership and staff? And before you do, I want to add that I think that it's very important to the extent possible that when you're having new leadership in a school, that the leadership come from within the school if you're trying to maintain the culture that you're developing. So they're very well rooted in it. Anyone? Yes. Anne is going to go first.
So, Larry, I was just going to say what you just said, which is that it shouldn't, I mean, it does matter if the school leadership leaves, but the leadership is really held by everybody in it. So if one person steps out, the gist of the school itself doesn't change or shift too much, because all the teachers and the kids and the parents are holding it. So if you have a couple of people leave, I think it's different if you have a large group of people leave. Those that remain have to find new ways to build it together with the new staff. But I would say for the most part, you want to be the kind of school leader anyway that if you stepped out, everything would keep rolling, because it is held in a shared way.
Okay, so no one else on that? Okay, so the next one is actually, Kelly, that was a hand up there?
I have a quick one. I think the power of, if you are just as a leader focused on student learning and not as equally focused on adult learning and cultivating teacher leadership, then I think you're going to have that problem when you step out. One thing that was really great when I was a director, when I had one of my three children and was on maternity leave, three new teachers were hired when I was gone. And the process that we have here at High Tech High has a lot of student and teacher voice. So our candidates come in, they do a demo lesson, the students give them feedback, they do speed dating where students interview them, teachers meet with them and interview them, they get together and plan a project and pitch it, they read an article based on equity and have a conversation about it. At the end of the day, the students and teachers come together and have a lot of voice in who's hired. Some of the best teachers who are now leaders in our school got hired that year while I was gone on leave as the director of that school, and I came back and took them out to lunch, and that was the first time I met them, and they were phenomenal because students and teachers had so much voice in that process.
Very helpful. Okay, great. Thanks for that example. I'm going to go to the next question. We have an unnamed submitter of this question, which is fine. What, despite any student, parent, or teacher pushback, are the non-negotiables at High Tech High? I'll begin with this. I think first and foremost, the idea of social class integration of students and not having, in terms of admissions, we have a blind lottery based on postal code. Whatever percent of kids reside in every postal code is the percent that are accepted by a computer. And there's no meritocratic element to that. We don't know grades, we have no letters of recommendation, we have no test scores, we don't want any of that kind of information. So we accept students that way, and secondly, we don't segregate them while we're here. So in that particular instance, as has been mentioned, we made a deal in our case with the University of California where Kelly could be taking honors and Larry could be taking regular and Kelly's doing extra work that's in the syllabus that Larry's not doing, but we're both in the same room at the same time with the same teacher. Therefore, I don't feel like I'm in the dumb class. And also, having watched Kelly for a semester, I realize because the person who's doing honors work is right next to me, and I'm seeing that actually this could be me, that about 70% of our kids migrate to honors anyway. So so the whole point is that we're not mispredicting, as our societies do, that we're not mispredicting who can and who can't do what. We're not allowing the school to mispredict based on race, based on ethnicity, based on gender, based on language ability, socioeconomic status, or any other, or standardized overemphasis on standardized test scores. We don't want to use any of those typical mispredictors. Those are the non-negotiables from my perspective. Anyone else want to jump in on one here?
Jeff? Yeah, I mean, it seems, I know it being negative is not, doesn't get anywhere, but it seems like it's more important to keep things out of a high school than to put things in. When you have a comprehensive high school, there's a comprehensive problems show up. It's amazing all of the traditional things that happen, and you know, and people say, well, it's tradition that, you know, the freshmen get beat up by the football players, and that's just doesn't seem so right to me, and I think it's important to keep things out, and even though you have to remember not that just because you live through it doesn't mean that it's the right thing to do, and it's definitely making your work transparent is something that I think is a non-negotiable at High Tech High. You have to show, the students have to show what they've learned, and the teachers have to show what's gone on in their classroom, and it's mm-hmm. and it's great for everybody. So that's mm-hmm. something that's added that I really appreciate.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. Okay, thank you. Kelly? Mm-hmm.
Two things that I think we try to keep out are anything that get in the way of authenticity as far as what our students and teachers are engaged in, and also relationships. So if we were talking about a schedule that would require teachers seeing 200 kids a day, they would not be able to do this type of learning or build the relationships they can, so we'd keep that out. Or if we were moving towards teachers having standards on the board and you need to teach this because it's on the test, and guess what? Everyone in ninth grade is going to do these extra four tests to even get better at taking the test in the spring. That would get in the way of people feeling authentically connected to their teaching, students feeling authentically connected to their work. So things that take away from authenticity or building relationships in our community, I think we try to keep those structures out of our schools.
Great. Okay, thank you. I'm going to go to the next question, and this is from Andrew in Philadelphia, and it is designed, I believe, to be somewhat high school-centric, and I already answered this question a bit with my honors option that I was just discussing, so it's possible that someone might want to address this at a different younger grade level if you want to jump in, but Andrew's question is, how do we embrace competency-based learning and avoid student segregation? I teach in a public high school with a high percentage of special ed students, and I have students in my class who can't read and students who love to read. Often it feels unfair to their needs as learners to have both together, I'm assuming. So does anybody at any grade level in this group want to address? I told you how we did it, Andrew. What we did was we found a way to have stronger and weaker students be in the same room at the same time and to meet the requirements of honors for college admissions. Does anybody want to address that? Because it obviously comes up at all grade levels. And Jeff? Jeff?
Yeah. And that's the greatest thing about projects is that everybody's at a different point, comes at a different point into projects, and they progress at a different point. And if the teacher's not in front of the class talking and being the center of attention, they're able to go around and give some certain students more help and give other students more guidance in different places they can go. So if you take yourself out as the centerpiece and the center of the classroom, and the students and their work is the center of the classroom, that their work is what what progresses, then you're able to work with all different levels of students in all different. That's what I got.
Good. Okay, Anne.
So I wanted to add to what Jeff was saying about the projects being a way to get around that. I think if you have kids that are struggling to read, those kids often have other talents in other areas that you can give them a role in a project that allows them to shine. You know, maybe the child that struggles at reading is really great at building things, or maybe they're a great artist, or maybe they're great at programming. And so it allows the other kids to see that child in a different light and not just as the child who struggles at reading. So building on other kids' strengths and weaknesses across groups and within groups, I think, makes a difference, too.
Mm-hmm. Kelly?
One thing that I've seen really work well with some of our teachers is having students create their own learning targets and design assessment tools with their teacher. So they might have a writing piece and then have a conference with their teacher and say, here are two goals that I have in my writing right now. I'm working on using evidence to back an argument or, you know, adding more detail in my writing. But that doesn't have to be the same for every student. So you might have some shared standards or learning targets, but you also can personalize or individualize those and have students create them with the teacher so that not every, you know, everyone's being met where they're at and also having the chance to grow.
Okay, next one, seeing no one else on that. So thanks for that good question, Andrew. Hopefully that helped. The question you're raising is certainly one of the most challenging ones that we face in schools today, especially if we're trying to have equitable spaces and not mispredict. The last question that we have tonight is the following. Larry, in designing a school that was very different from previous experiences, how do you determine what to include and what not to include, especially when those don't include things could change the feel of the school and muddle the intended purpose? Well, you know, when we all make mistakes in life, and we all do, you frequently say, I know I'm going to make mistakes, but I want to make new mistakes. I don't want to make that mistake again. Sometimes it's about a personal relationship. Sometimes it's about a school. And so I've seen things like, for example, having a PA system in a school. I think having a public address system makes it feel like a bus station. Our schools tend to feel much calmer. If you've been a teacher in a school where there's a public address system that interrupts all the classes to ask, you know, Mary to come to the main office, you know, Mary makes it to the main office, and it shouldn't have that kind of feel to it that anybody has the power to interrupt all of our thought and discourse in one fell click of a button, because they tend to be overused. We also don't have bells. Those aren't necessary either. Also, if you want to go to the bathroom in high school, just go to the bathroom. You don't have to curtsy to do everything. I think that there's a lot of things like that, that just are expectations that this is what schools are supposed to look like. I've met with several parents in my career when they say, gee, this school is really different from other schools. And I'll say, well, it is. And I'll ask them, and I suggest this to the person who asked this question, ask parents when they're questioning these things, ask them about their own school experience, and they will often tell you that it was somewhat fragmented and alienating, but that they want the same thing for their kids, you know. So you're mm-hmm. trying to walk them away from it. When we first opened, we had a lot of parents when we first opened who said that they were scared about the way we were doing math. They were scared that we weren't doing ability grouping, and they said they couldn't leave. And I didn't ask them to leave, but I would say, oh, well, how come you can't leave if you feel that way? They said, because my kid loves coming too much. We heard that a lot. It was kind of curious. Oh, that's a bad thing that your kid loves coming to school. And then for us, the college admissions data at the back end, colleges were really loving getting our kids. So the parents finally said, well, the kids love coming. The colleges love accepting them. I guess they're doing something that's basically working. So, yeah, I think you can figure out what things are not necessary. But just don't assume that you need to overload your school and pack in all these things. Anybody else going to take a shot at that one? And seeing no hands. Okay. Mm-hmm. Seeing no hands, right? Okay, I'm going to go. So we have, I want to thank everybody out there in the universe who's been listening to us tonight and taking the time to listen to us. This is our second. We have several to go on Wednesday nights, 5 p.m. Pacific. And the panelists have, I want to thank every one of you for being here tonight. And we're going to be having 1 minute for Kelly Wilson to introduce something that might be of interest to someone or someone that you know. Kelly, would you introduce this very interesting opportunity regarding the grad school of Ed?
Mm-hmm. Great. So through a generous gift from the Walton Family Foundation, we can have 12 fellows here next year and 12 the following doing our school leadership master's program, the one-year program, tuition-free, a $2,000 per month living stipend, and they're embedded in our schools learning how to lead by apprenticeship with a high-tech high director, and it's really a learning by doing model. So Patrick's going to help post some information on your Google Plus community if anyone's interested in applying to that program. Applications are due February 10th. Is our priority deadline, and then we take rolling applications after that.
Great. Thanks so much, Kelly. Okay, now Patrick is going to take a look ahead for next week.
We're looking ahead at, let me just... Sorry.
Apollo 13.
We're looking ahead at student mix and at pedagogy. Actually, Jeff Rodden's video that he one additional information he gave you all for next week, and another couple animated videos that Andrew Globe created for the course. I'm really looking forward to that. Remember to check your inboxes for the newsletter that's going to come out, because it'll tell you what the due dates are. A reminder to all of the students who are working on stuff for the rest of the week that your Activity 2 work is due on Friday at 2 p.m. Pacific time, and the response is only two people, not to respond to everybody, only two people is due on Saturday at 2 p.m. Pacific time, and then we'll be ready.
Okay, thank you, Patrick. And before we have the goodbyes from our panelists, we have put over the last couple years a lot of time into making these animated videos. Many of these videos take, kind of like the Sam Seidel video. He wrote a book which took him 5 years to write called Hip Hop Genius, and it's on Vimeo. And then he was able to make a 5-minute video and pack all of that, but he couldn't have done it in 5 minutes if he hadn't spent 5 years writing the book. We did that with several videos that are out there. So remember my request at the beginning of tonight's hangout, which is, do you think we should look at a video in future courses, and they're only 4 or 5 minutes long each, and have that be part of the discourse or not, because you've already seen them, and that's a debate that we're having. So please do check them out. And Anne, you're first off with good nights.
Oh, okay. I thank you very much. It was really nice to be part of the conversation. I think the questions from the session helped me think more critically about the work we're doing at High Tech Elementary, so thanks for that input.
Okay. Jeff?
Thanks so much. It was a pleasure being here, and I feel like it's proven that I can be responsible and not say anything crazy to everyone I work with. And I'd like to thank Dan Wise for being part of and listening to us tonight.
Jeff, even the blind squirrel gets the acorn once in a while. And Kelly Wilson?
We're a little disappointed, Jeff. You're usually a little bit more of a troublemaker. So
he will be in the future, I'm sure.
Great conversation. Thank you for including me. And I guess I'm left thinking about what we know about motivation and how to intrinsically motivate people, and it's really about people having a purpose to what they're doing. So I think having the purpose for your school and then having that be a shared purpose that people feel connected to, you'll have a school full of students and adults that are just intrinsically motivated to learn and to be there. So good luck in creating your schools, and thanks for having me.
Thanks, Kelly. Maria?
I'm going to keep it really brief. Thanks for having me on this, and it was really fun.
Good. We'll see you again here. Thanks in the future. Okay, Patrick?
Thank you for having me, and I will be here all the time answering all of the questions that are ever asked on the thing. So, and Laura McBain is just telling me to plug the Deeper Learning MOOC. It started this week, I believe. And
it's going to be starting this week. That's correct.
Yeah, so check it out. It's going to be really cool. And you can
get to there by going to hdhp.org and clicking on the people event.
Okay, very good. And finally, from me to everyone out there who's stuck with us and is listening, I know we all have very busy lives. Thank you so much for joining us this evening. Hopefully we'll see you next Wednesday night. Take good care. Bye-bye.